We're living in an era of information overload. We've more knowledge than ever before. But what do we do with it all? Notion is a place where any team can write, plan, organize, and rediscover the joy of play. It's a workspace designed not just for making progress, but for getting inspired. Notion is the AI-powered workspace where the everyday takes care of itself. Meetings have summaries, docs find themselves, and every question has an answer. Because Notion AI turns knowledge into action, and I know that myself because I once asked it to write an introduction for a How to Fail episode, and I have to say, it was so helpful and so convincing. Try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/fail. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/fail, and start turning ideas into action. And when you use our link, you're supporting our show, notion.com/fail. Hello, and welcome to How to Fail with Elizabeth Day, the podcast that celebrates the things that haven't gone right. This is a podcast about learning from our mistakes and understanding that why we fail ultimately makes us stronger. Because learning how to fail in life actually means learning how to succeed better. I'm your host, author and journalist Elizabeth Day, and every week I'll be asking a new interviewee what they've learned from failure. This extra special live episode of How to Fail is brought to you by Beija London. Women know that a great bra you love has the power to positively impact the way you feel. Beija London's number one goal is to make women feel amazing in their underwear as they are, because you alone are enough. I'm the proud owner of several Beija London bras, and whenever I wear one, they make me feel held and empowered, and they look great too. Beija makes perfectly simple and elegant, supportive bras with considered design for the needs of the cup size from AA to H. Beija is also women-owned, consisting of a team of six females who thrive off making other women smile when they look in the mirror, and we're very glad they do. Beija are generously gifting you, the live How to Fail audience, an exclusive discount on their amazing bra collection. For this month only, How to Fail live guests will receive 50% off. Yes, 50. You should have received a card from the founders as you came in this evening with a QR code leading you directly to the website. Enjoy, and thank you so much to Beija London. My guest tonight is a double platinum-selling singing queen who kept us dancing through the pandemic lockdowns with weekly discos streamed live from her kitchen. She started out as the lead singer of indie band The Audience at the age of 17. After they split, she was catapulted into the mainstream with the joyous summer hit If This Ain't Love with Groovejet. It was to be her first number one, and famously kept Victoria Beckham off the top spot in the year 2000. 22 years on, and Sophie Ellis-Bextor has released six studio and two compilation albums, written a memoir, and launched her own podcast, where she interviews working mothers called, aptly enough, Spinning Plates. Given that she herself is the mother of five boys, ranging in age from 18 to 3, it's safe to say she knows what she's talking about. Oh, and in 2021, she found the time to do a 24-hour kitchen disco dance-a-thon, which raised over £1 million for children in need. Of success, Ellis-Bextor says, "I tasted huge success with my first album, and when it's happening, it feels like a roller coaster you can't get off. You should be very careful about wishing for success on that scale." But of course, as we all know, she's here tonight to talk about failure, and we can't wait to hear what she has to say about it. Shoreditch Town Hall, please give the biggest round of applause for our very own dancing queen, the brilliant Sophie Ellis-Bextor.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you.
My sartorial twin.
Hello. Is this the meeting for women wearing silver boots and black dresses?
You've come to the right place.
Just wanted to check.
I have to say, we didn't plan this.
It's quite extraordinary, though, isn't it?
I know. If you're listening to the podcast at home, we are both wearing silver boots and black velvet dresses.
I've gone for a tartier interpretation.
And I love it, and I'm turned on by it. I've gone for, like, the Jane Eyre version.
You look gorgeous. And what's quite funny as well is I'm not really, like, a silver boot kind of gal.
Me neither, my first pair.
Really? Okay, me too. And I was like, I have to wear them, and tonight is the night.
Yes.
And we thought the same thing.
It's meant to be. Well, we're very glad that those boots have walked you here.
They have.
And I am very intrigued by that quote I ended on. I don't know if you heard it backstage.
I did, I heard everything, yes.
Why should you be careful about wishing for success, do you think?
I think, well, because if I ever meet anybody that's like someone young who's looking to get into the music industry, I always say that bit before you get signed is the really precious bit, actually, because that's when you've got complete autonomy and you can make mistakes and try things out. And as soon as you sign that record deal, there's a whole bevy of people who suddenly get very involved and they've all got opinions. So that first bit is really, really precious. And I kind of had a mixture of both. A public thing because I signed a deal, but also a private thing because the way my band ended, like most people didn't really know about that by the time I did Groovejet. It kind of happened very quietly to the public eye.
Because I hadn't realised, when it came to researching you, how long you've been in this game. It doesn't feel like that at all, and you don't look like that at all. But then to suddenly say, wow, 22 years you've been at this, and I think that that's very, very impressive because from my perspective, you've always stayed true to yourself. And yet you've always somehow remained relevant. Where do you think that comes from? Do you think that's actually to do with authenticity, that that's the connecting force?
Well, firstly, I don't know if I 100% agree with that, really.
It's suddenly turned news night. I love it.
I know, and I'm sitting really
pensively. I put it to you.
Yeah. I know. I think actually trying to stay relevant is probably one of the worst things you can do if you're trying to be creative. Because once you start trying to think objectively about what you're doing, it's just not going to work very well. And certainly if you do the things that make you your heart happy, you're more likely to have a happier outcome, I think. But I think it's actually been even longer. I started when I was 16, I started singing, and I'm 43 now. So it has been a really long time and lots of twists and turns along the way. And I remember when I was making my first solo album, I met with Alex James from Blur to songwrite with him. And he said this thing that really stuck with me. So this was like in 2001. And he said, nobody's, you know, career is a straight trajectory upwards. There's always all these peaks and troughs. And actually, it's completely true. And if you remember that, it does make the troughs that little bit easier to bear because you're not thinking, oh my God, I'm defined by this.
Yeah, and you know it will pass.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you're the same age as I am. Another thing we have in common, black velvet, silver boots and 43.
There you go.
I love my 40s. How are you finding yours?
Yeah, I really like it as well, actually. I wasn't really sure what to expect because I really loved my 30s so much. And I always had a clear idea of what 30s would be like. And that sounds odd, but I always thought I'd enjoy them. 40s was a bit of a question mark. But actually, I think 40s is great. And I'm really trying to embrace being even more unapologetic about the things that I want to do and how I want to spend my time and all that sort of stuff. I think I've been a people pleaser for far too long. So 40s should be, let's put an end to that, shall we?
Yes.
And with that, I'm off. No, sorry.
So interesting then, because I think we've been on a similar journey.
Oh, really?
Yes. So for me, when I realised my people-pleasing had to stop was when I got divorced from my ex-husband. And at that stage, you realise that there are going to be people who will never understand why you made that decision or what happened.
That's
and
true.
You have to be totally content holding your own truth and understanding that the people who matter are the ones who will get it.
That sounds very wise.
But it's a great baptism for someone who always outsourced her sense of self to other people's opinions. I had to get comfortable very quickly with the fact that some people had very negative opinions of me, including my ex. But did you have a moment where you suddenly thought, actually, this people-pleasing can't continue?
Well, actually, in some ways, I was thinking that what you did is quite... You almost like you had this big baptism of it. You just like pulled completely the rug out from under you and had to announce, like everybody had to know that that was happening. I don't think I've had quite the same sort of dramatic moment. I think it's more a series of little things, really, and just trying to recognise in myself the things I've been doing to make other people happy, which, to be honest as well, there's a bit of narcissism in that sometimes, isn't there? Because actually you don't know if they are that bothered about whether you show up to that thing or you go that extra mile. You know, you might be giving yourself a much bigger role in their life than you really play. So I think it's just experimenting with, well, what happens if I actually do what I feel like I want to do, and then seeing that actually it's fine, there's no big ripples, it's okay, but you just feel that bit better.
Very interesting what you say there, because I think you're right that there is an element of seeking to control or manage other people's emotions about you, which obviously you can't do.
No, and you don't really know what people are thinking about all that anyway, you know, it's like they're probably not thinking too much at all, really.
I'm guessing you're not a control freak, though, with five sons. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Am I a control freak? I can be a little bit, actually. I think I'm quite a control freak when it comes to being a parent, and that there's lots of areas that I would probably say I like having more control of than Richard does. So I'll do all the, if I'm not working, I'll do like all the mornings and all the bedtimes. And sometimes I'll think, oh, you know, he's not taking as big a role with that. But then I realize that's actually come from me, because I really like doing all that stuff. And I like being the first person they see in the morning and kind of knowing what's going on in their life in that way. I'm not saying he doesn't, but just in my head, that's how it goes about. So I think I can be a bit of a control freak, actually.
Okay, well, that's interesting. That all tracks.
Yeah.
There were a couple of quotes that I wanted to read out, do that embarrassing thing that interviewers sometimes do of trawling through past interviews.
Oh, golly.
But these are really good quotes.
I've come out with a lot of rubbish, so.
No, these are really good, and they really spoke to me, and I know that they'll speak to people here. One was about boundaries. It's been my goal to be unapologetic, kind, considerate, but clear with my boundaries. That's one thing I want to ask you about. Okay. The other one, I'm too frightened of confrontation, so I will always tip, even if the service has been really shoddy. I don't think I've ever felt so seen. How, as a people pleaser, do you navigate boundaries?
Ooh, well, I guess there's two forms of that. There's probably a professional side where I actually still kind of get on with things, and I really like coming away from work things feeling like I've been professional and everybody's found it seamless to work with me. Like, that matters to me very much. But I think when it comes to more personal things, I think that's probably where that's taken hold more. And I guess the most sort of significant thing of that was probably when I split up with my ex, who wasn't a very nice man. And I think that was a very important thing that I did. And at the time, this is a long time ago now, like 20 years ago, but it took a lot of strength at the time to make sure that I walked away from that and also never let that happen to me again.
Yeah.
But yeah, the thing with the waiters and like tipping and stuff, that's actually funny you bring that up, because I am still like that. And if someone's really grumpy in service, I'll do my best to try and win them over. Like, that becomes a total challenge.
Yes.
However, I've also starting to feel like proper middle-aged me. And if something's not been great, I'm now that person who say, actually, I think you should know. Like, my mum and I the other day had a Sunday roast, and the Yorkshire puddings, they simply weren't that good.
Wow.
So I made sure they knew. I just thought, you know, I said, I'm sure, you know, it's important that you know that the Yorkshire puddings just weren't up to scratch.
Well, and then
they really weren't. They were rubbish. We all left them.
And then the thing is, they will end up liking you more, because there's a respect to that as well. They can see the honesty to it. They can see you're being true to your Yorkshire pudding self.
I hope that's true, because the other half of me thinks they're going to spit in it next time, aren't they?
I know, it's just a risk you have to take, just in life as in restaurants.
You know what, if they're fluffy, so long as they're good Yorkshire puddings, I'll take it.
I think it's actually very rare to get a good Yorkshire pudding. I don't know if I've ever had a really good Yorkshire pudding.
I can cook you a good Yorkshire
pudding. Can you?
Yeah, I really
okay,
can.
Great.
And
well, we'll do that.
And Nanny Claire, I'll definitely sort you out.
I don't want to skip over what you just said there about your ex. You wrote about that beautifully in your book. Because it was a coercively controlling relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And I have also been in one of those. And I wonder if it was around the same time where that relationship existed before the language around coercive control did.
100%, yeah.
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 And I didn't know what it was.
No.
And it's only looking back that I can see it as that.
Yeah, I'm very much in agreement with that, yeah.
So how has it been for you processing what you went through in retrospect with the available language?
I think it's actually been really very empowering, and I think that's why when I wrote about it in the book, I found it really liberating, and it was almost quite a literal scene in my head of seeing sort of 17, 18-year-old me and kind of going back into the scene and being like, it's okay, I've got this now. Because it felt brilliant to take something that had been painful on such a private scale, but then say how much better I was feeling about everything now on a public one and talk through it. I'm just not scared of that anymore. Mm. It felt really nice, and it did feel a little bit brave, but more so it felt right.
How long did it take you after that relationship ended not to feel scared?
Well, probably a few years, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Ditto. The reason I ask you that is because I feel that there will probably be people here who are going through that or have split up with someone and are in that stage of feeling fearful and panicked and confused as to whether they've done the right thing.
Yeah.
And I always want to say to those people, that confusion passes.
It really does.
And it's a sort of default narrative that is not good for you, that someone has made you feel.
Absolutely. You've been diminished. You know, you've been made to feel that your opinions and your feelings haven't got as much validity. And so you have to build that back up, actually, and learn to trust people who are just being kind and not wait for the bit where they snap. That doesn't always happen. Not everybody has that.
Yeah. I've grown to realise that true love is about feeling safe.
Yeah, I think that's very true, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And it sounds so obvious and so simple, but it took me a really long time to learn.
Absolutely. I thought for a long time that being in love was all fiery and tempestuous and had that passion meant you had these horrible, ugly moments and that was all the drama was all part of it. And I think actually, probably when I started dating Richard, I was initially a little bit suspicious of the fact that he didn't go into that gear.
Yeah.
I was a bit confused by that because I was so familiar with that happening and being called an idiot and whatever else would happen. But once that I learned to trust the newness of what was really happening, I realised, oh my gosh, that person, they never loved me at all. Mm. They can't have done. That's not what love looks like.
Thank you so much for talking about that. I want to talk about Richard, but perhaps I can share something first, which is I had exactly the same experience when I met my now husband. And he was saying these things to me that I found incredibly unromantic and pedestrian. And then I would quote them to my friends and they'd be like, oh my gosh, what an incredible thing to say. What an emotionally evolved man you have. And one of those things was, he said to me, it was on our third date, poor thing, just literally our third date. And I was like, well, where's this going then? And he was, because what I was used to was someone showering, like love bombing me, saying, let's run away to Rio, and then letting me down in a very dramatic way.
Mm.
And similarly, that for me was kind of passion and love.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I don't know, but if we walk parallel paths together for a week, a month, or a lifetime, I'll have enjoyed that experience. And I was like, oh
that is lovely.
How unromantic. And now I'm like,
oh, wow.
Now I look back and I'm like, that's the best thing he could have said, because it gives you your agency. Like, I had agency there. I could decide. I had an equal role in that relationship and I hadn't had that for so long.
The love bombing you're talking about, Richard didn't even tell me he loved me till we were going out for months, actually.
Ditto.
And so
when he
said it, it was like, really like, oh, wow. And I could tell that, you know, those feelings were there, but it just was really powerful to wait.
Yeah, well, I'm sure when he said it as a commitment, so that's why it took that long. Tell us a little bit about Richard, because I know you got pregnant really quickly, so that's so, like, intimate.
That's fine.
But it's such a great story.
Yes, we'd been going out a whole 6 weeks when I realised I was pregnant.
Wow.
I did so many pregnancy tests because I was just incredulous, and then we were together and I said, I'm going to do another test and I'm just going to see if it is definitely positive. And we started making, that's right. Then his Dan from The Feeling called, because he had a technical problem with the computer when they were recording some demos, which actually is exactly the same dynamic of their relationship now, like 20 years on. And as Richard was on the phone, I held up this test and Richard just looked at it and went like this to me, like thumbs up, like yes, and I can finish this phone call. And then we just made ourselves like, it was like fish and chips or something, like fish fingers and chips, like oven chips, but like completely in the day. It's like total zombies sort of doing all the things and then occasionally just laughing, like, aww, this is ridiculous. But yeah, it was quite an intense time. And Richard didn't actually move in until 2 weeks before Sunny was born. And then Sunny ended up being born 2 months early. So we'd only been dating for 8 months when we had a baby. So it was all, yeah, it was all quite quick.
Yeah. Well, as you know, this podcast is all about how things not going according to plan can somehow turn out better than you ever expected.
Sure.
Has that been your experience? It'd be awkward if you said no now.
It really would. It would be terrible.
Yeah.
You know, this is a place for honesty.
Yeah.
It's so hard to imagine that that hadn't happened now. And I always feel like with Sonny, who's now 18, he's like this sort of embodiment of our early romance. And he was just there. We were like a little family from the get-go. And I really can't imagine it going any other way now. And actually, to his credit, even though we were 24 and Richard had never even held a baby at that point, he really took it in his stride. It was quite impressive. And actually, my mum, who's here tonight, she gave me and him a brilliant bit of advice, which was, it might not be the right time, it might not be the right man, but it's the right baby. And that gave us permission to look forward to welcoming our baby, but also still date and still get to know one another, which sounds a bit, it was a bit green card at times. You know that film where they sort of race through their early like romance? Like, so it's a bit like that. It's like we went on holiday somewhere hot, then we went somewhere cold. It was like, we've done loads. It was a bit stupid, but yeah. When Sonny was there, it was like, oh yeah, there he is.
What a beautiful piece of advice from your mother. And seeing as you bring her up...
She's good at advice.
You know that I'm obsessed with your mother. And I think, terrifyingly, Janet Ellis also knows that I'm obsessed with her.
I can hear her laughing, actually.
Where is she? Oh yeah, hello. My favourite ever Blue Peter presenter. I am the proud owner of a Blue Peter badge. From the Janet Ellis vintage. And but Sophie, I discovered something incredibly shocking about you.
Oh, gosh.
Which is that you used to sell Blue Peter badges in the playground. So I'd like to call you to account on that.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. Well, actually, it's an opportunity. Yeah, this was when I was at primary school. So my mum was presenting Blue Peter from when I was 4 to when I was 8. And so every day on the programme, she had to wear a fresh badge. So they would be coming home, and there was a few accumulating.
Sorry, every day you would wear a fresh Blue Peter badge?
Every time you would film the show.
I was supposed to give them back.
Oh, she was supposed to give them back.
There's two criminals in the room.
There was a whole black market going on.
The apple doesn't fall far from the tree. Yeah, my mum was supposed to give them back, but didn't. Instead, she came home, gave them to me, 50p in the playground, a pound if it was with an autograph. So I'd come up to my mum with those little like little tiny cards with, you know, a picture of her and the little emblem. I'd say, Mum, can you sign some of these? And she'd be like, what are these for? And I'd say, oh, I'm maybe going to sell them back to people. But the worst thing is I never really collected the money because no kid at 6 has any change on them. So it
rubbish.
Was a really flawed plan. Yeah.
But that's actually a very good deal, because with my Blue Peter badge, I got in for free to Madame Tussauds.
Exactly.
Which is actually really expensive to get into, anyway.
I know, I had my 8th birthday there.
Yeah,
we had my birthday party. I swear to God, this like sowed a devilish seed in me, because for my 8th birthday, we went to Madame Tussauds and we walked straight in past the queue. It was like a very sexy moment for an 8-year-old. Yeah.
Before we get onto your failures, it would be so remiss of me not to ask you about the Kitchen Disco, which... Thank you, because you got so many of us through really dark times.
Oh,
and I know
you thank me. It was fun.
Well, you went through your own dark times in lockdown.
Mm.
Did it help you?
Immeasurably, yes, absolutely, yes. So, I mean, you know, our lockdown was much the same as a lot of other people's lockdown. You know, it was tense and shouty, and sometimes strangely quite nice, like a bank holiday, and then it'd go back into tension and watching the news and the heaviness and all the numbers going up. So the discos, which we would did from the first Friday of the first lockdown all the way through, they just gave us a really welcome distraction and an amazing community of people who would come round. And I felt such affection for everybody that came over. I can't really describe it. Even now, I sort of struggle to put the words in because it was actually very emotional. I cried a lot during those discos. And I just felt this real purity of connection. And also, it was nice to be silly and do something a bit fun. Yeah, they were kind of magical in amongst all this other stuff that really wasn't. And yeah, we had lots going on. I mean, my lovely stepdad John died in July of 2020. So it was, you know, extraordinary time to be living through, really.
Mm. I'm so sorry for your loss, and I'm so sorry to Janet. And I'm glad we get to mention his name.
Me too.
Have you done Desert Island Discs?
No, I haven't.
If you could just have one piece of music on your desert island, have you thought about what it would be?
Just one?
I mean, you get 7 on desert islands.
You get loads, don't you?
Okay.
Wow, you're really mean.
Sorry.
When you're on an island, there's no one there. One piece of music, go. What you mean, just one song?
Oh, a quintessential, the one that will get you dancing every single time if it comes on in a club.
Because let's face it, if I was on my own on a desert island with a bit of disco, I probably would dance. I'd go for Don't Leave Me This Way, the Thelma Houston version. I just adore it. And for me, the mark of a good song is if it works the same magic on you every time you hear it.
Yeah.
And that one always gets me dancing.
So excellent.
Have that, please.
Mine would be House of Pain, Jump Around.
Oh, good one. That's a fun
which
one.
Which also literally gets you jumping.
Yeah, okay. I would dance to that.
It's also because I can't sing, so when I do karaoke, I do karaoke rap.
Do you know all the rap of that?
No.
Pack it up, pack it in, let me begin.
I do know it, but I don't want you to ask me to do it. So.
If you did that, I would do Let's Get Ready to Rumble by PJ and Duncan, because I know the rap of that one, yeah.
That's amazing. So are the same generation. Maybe at the end, we'll do that, once I've heard that.
When everybody's gone.
Okay, yeah. Okay, let's get on to your failures, because your first one touches on something that I mentioned in the introduction and that you brought up, which is that you were dropped by your label with your first band, The Audience. So tell us what happened there.
Yeah, that was pretty seismic, really. So when I was 16, me and my girlfriends used to go clubbing every Friday night to this place called Pop Scene. It was an indie club. And through that, I met a guy that said, I've got a friend looking for a singer in a band. And I thought, oh, I should probably do that because it'll be a fun thing to... At that time, I wasn't looking to be a singer. I just thought, oh, that'd be a good story to tell my grandkids that I used to be in a band once. And lo and behold, this guy, Billy, that was forming the band, he had really big plans for it. And it was called The Audience. And so between 16 and 18, we did gigs around and started to get record deal offers. So in the same year I sat my A-levels, I turned 18 in April, I signed the record deal in May, sat my last A-level in June, and then July just went off on tour. So all my girlfriends were going off to university, and I was having this adventure with this indie band, and it just kind of lifted me up and just showed me another way. And it definitely made me realise, oh my gosh, singing is it for me. I found my thing. But at that time, I hadn't really had to question too much, what road I was going to go on. It just sort of took me along with it. But then after we did our first album, which didn't chart as highly as the label, as Mercury, we're hoping, we got dropped when I was 19. And I just felt completely high and dry. All my girlfriends were still at university. And I just thought, I have royally mucked this up. I haven't got the option now of going to uni because in my mind I was going to be like the Fonz, like this old student if I then went along after that. I didn't have any employable qualifications. All I wanted to do was sing, and I thought, I've just had the highlight of my career and it's all over and I'm not even 20. Wow. So I just felt really like I just screwed everything up, like hugely, and I genuinely didn't know which way to turn next.
So how did you get through that? How long did that phase last?
In reality, the whole thing probably only lasted about 18 months, including the bit where we were still with the label, but it was clear it wasn't really working and all the ideas were drying up and no one knew what to do with the band. But it felt like an eternity because I didn't know what would be at the end of that. And I just felt really, I think, kind of humiliated, but also really blue. And so I'm the sort of person that just needs something, some little project, something going on, just a reason to get out of bed. So I did a few bits and bobs. I started writing a really terrible book, which I tried to find actually when I was writing my autobiography, and quite luckily I couldn't find it because I know it's terrible. And it was a sort of fiction loosely based on a girl who was wanting to sign, signed a record deal as a teenager. I mean, it was like, and I remember it was very, very middle class. The girl was called Bella, and it's in the first paragraph it said something like, Bella was in her bedroom with the Designers Guild fabric. It was like very much like, I mean, that shows you the quality of the writing. So that started, and I couldn't really get anywhere with that. And I also started making, weirdly, these little cloth bags, which is a very strange phase I went through. But I think I just liked to be crafting, so I got this amazing thread from the haberdashers near my flat and was making things all the time. But the reality was, like, the money was sort of running out, and I didn't really have much of a path. And then I got a phone call from... Oh, that's right, I got scouted at Topshop. And so I signed up with a modelling agent, Models One. So I would go on castings, but I wasn't successful at that either.
I mean, that sounds like a horrible thing to sign up to when you're grieving something that's gone wrong, because there you're being rejected and getting jobs, I imagine, because you're
not really
so beautiful. But
that's kind, but no, I wasn't. But that must be
that must be awful, being rejected ceaselessly by people who are just judging you on how you look.
Also, I felt quite old to be doing that as well, to be honest, because by that time I think I was 20 and a lot of the models were much younger. They were 16, 17, 18. And I remember at the front of my book I had the pictures that were forming my portfolio of modelling, and at the back would be some press articles from my band. So sometimes if they saw it, they'd flick through to the back and go, what's this? And I'd go, oh yeah, I used to be in a band. And it just felt all a bit sad and a bit like a time gone by, and no one was very interested in that. And I didn't really know how to kickstart that as well. I wasn't expecting the band to implode, and even when we got dropped, I thought the band itself would stay together, the other musicians. I didn't really understand that that was the end of that as well, so it took me a little while for that penny to drop, I think.
Who did you blame, if anyone?
Well, actually, that's interesting you asked that question, because I think I blamed lots of people, and it was a real pivotal moment in me of deciding to never actually put the blame of something not working on anyone else again, actually, just to take responsibility. There's loads of reasons why things don't work, and actually it's kind of amazing and beautiful when things do work out, and blaming things is just a fruitless enterprise. It just leads to resentment and bitterness, and Lord knows there are enough bitter musicians out there. I do not ever want to be one of those.
So do you think you made the conscious decision then not to be bitter?
Absolutely, I did, yeah. Right. I thought, this has got to be your growing up moment. That had been handed to you on a plate, mm-hmm. and if you really want to sing, you'll sing whether it's good times or bad, and you won't blame other people if it doesn't work out. You'll just be responsible for your own thing. And it was really significant that I made that decision, I think.
And we're talking about a very specific time in our culture, because we're talking about the 1990s, if I've done my maths correctly.
Yeah. So this is very late 90s, yeah.
So what was that experience like, being, first of all, being a female front woman of an indie band in the Ladette 90s, and then being a model in the 90s, which had a singular kind of body type? What was that like?
Well, definitely the bit of being in the band was, I look back and I'm actually quite shocked at what the culture was like and the questions I was asked. And I think it was a really tough time to be a young woman, and I felt like it was sink or swim. So the culture at that time was very much, it was what they called ladette culture. So women trying to be, saying they can be like lads, but it wasn't like they just wanted to, equality, you know, of options with men. It was like they wanted to be able to be, act like the kind of men I wouldn't want to spend time with either, thanks. Mm. So it was, I mean, I suppose in it, I can see that there was a kernel in it that was significant, but how it was presented was always a bit gross, really. So it was all about like drinking loads and one-night stands, but it was almost at the sacrifice of, even if that wasn't what you want, if you didn't want to do that, you were still supposed to do that anyway. Yeah. So it's quite, yeah, it did feel quite sink or swim in that regard. And I looked back actually at some articles and some of the questions I was asked, you know, as like an 18, 19-year-old girl about, I don't know, sexual fantasies, or like, what would you do if you came home and found your boyfriend in bed with another man, or this kind of thing. And I just felt like a rabbit in headlights for a lot of it, but you had to fake that you felt completely cool with all this. And I did Never Mind the Buzzcocks, and it was just horrible, just really like being goaded, but you had to stick it out because otherwise they'd won. So you had to just be like, yeah, I'll just brave this out until it's over.
Otherwise you didn't get the banter.
Exactly. Yeah. You'd taken yourself too seriously, and you were supposed to be able to hack it and be really cool with all that. And I just felt like I was always faking that, and that all these other amazing women out there were doing brilliantly at it, but just I was the fraud.
Hello. Now, I would like to tell you about the podcast Miss Me on BBC Sounds, hosted by best friends Lily Allen and Makita Oliver. I mean, what a duo. Lily was one of my first guests on How to Fail, fun fact. And Makita's mum, Andy, has been on too. Miss Me is a podcast from two women who comment on popular culture, whose experiences have been shaped through the noughties, and who retain as much relevance today with their scathingly funny and fiercely smart thoughts and feelings. Lily Allen and Makita Oliver are lifelong friends. Their mothers have been best friends their whole lives, so they grew up together, and the conversations they have in Miss Me represent a genuine close friendship that brings a sense of nostalgia and trust. Prepare to laugh, scream and cry all at once with unique insights and juicy anecdotes from their lives and the world around them. Miss Me with Lily Allen and Makita Oliver. Listen on BBC Sounds. Do you have a question about all things love, dating, sex, and relationships? Maybe you're happy in a relationship and want to hear other people's nightmare dating experiences. La 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 Let Me Explain is a qualified social worker and sex and relationships educator. And on her podcast, It's Not You, It's Them, But It Might Be You, La La answers listeners' questions around love, dating, parenting, and whatever they throw her way. It's Not You, It's Them, But It Might Be You is out on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. What about modelling at a time when the body ideal was this very svelte, grungy type of model? What was that like for you?
Well, to be honest, I think I felt more of that judgment more from my singing days, really, because every time I do photo shoots, I felt like that's the bit I probably underestimated about being in the band, was that as soon as I started singing, it wasn't just about the band or the songs, it was about how I looked, and I just wasn't quite ready for that. And in fact, the very first article that was written about the band started with this paragraph about me walking into a cafe and the journalist saying, is she old? Is she young? Is she ugly? Is she beautiful? And it just really rocked me to my core, because I thought, oh, I didn't even know they were trying to weigh me up like that. I had no idea. Whereas by the time I got to modelling, which really was only a few months, I think I did it for about four or five months, I was actually in quite a different place then anyway, because I was actually not really, I'd got very controlling, because I think I was really a little bit depressed, so I was not really eating that well, and I actually kind of was very, like for me, very unusually thin at that time actually, because I got really fixated on it, because probably because everything else had gone pear-shaped and I didn't really know what else I could do.
And did those experiences teach you, did they teach you then about who you really were? Was there, when you got through it, a sense of, oh no, I had all these people saying these things about me, but I know who I am? Or did it take you much longer to get there? It took me bloody ages, and I didn't go through half of what you went through.
I don't know. That's hard to answer, because I'm not quite, I don't know if I really had that much self-awareness like that. I do know that when I got the opportunity to do a Groove Jet single with Spiller, I seized that with both hands, and I was like, I'm just going to really appreciate the fact that I've got this song. And it was of huge significance that the song was a house dance track, because it just gave me a massive path out away from all the judgment of the indie press, which I felt was very harsh, and I'd been so sort of burned by that. I thought, this is great. They'll never even know it came out. They won't even write about this. They won't be judging it, because it's just not even in their remit. So that was a big part of what made me want to do that song, was like, oh, this is another island. I haven't visited there before. And I liked the feel of the song, and it was like, let's just see where this takes me. It was quite exciting. And then when that gave me the opportunity to go solo, I think by then I was like, right, I'm just going to really go for this, and I'm going to do things that work for me, and I'm going to just drink it all in, because this is golden. The fact I have another opportunity is golden.
You have a very specific style on stage and in person. I mean, obviously, you've dressed fantastically
never see anyone,
tonight.
I never see anyone dressed like me, like, ever.
I know, it's so unique. Did that come naturally, or was that a sort of Beyoncé moment where she assumes the stage persona of Sasha Fierce? Were you kind of curating a stage persona that you could step into?
Well, in another surprising twist in the differences between me and Beyoncé, I would say no. It was all the things I really loved, and I think I was very fortunate. I fell on my feet with a lot of things. All the people I ended up working with for my first ever single, literally the makeup artist, the woman who did my hair, the video director. I still work with all those women now. And they were brilliant at just saying, but what do you want to do? And really listening. And that was just, I just loved it. I mean, I don't understand musicians who don't like making music videos and all that. It's glorious. Like, you spend a whole day living out a dream. It's incredible. All these people are working really hard to make it happen. I absolutely love it.
Are you grateful for that failure now of being dropped by?
Definitely. It's been a hugely defining thing that happened to me. And yeah, it was massive. I just felt completely like everything had completely gone pear-shaped, and there was nothing I could think of. So everything since then it gives you that Teflon of you're not afraid of what happens if it all goes away. I've had that feeling. It's awful, but you do get the other side of it. And obviously I've been lucky. I'm only talking about in a professional sense, you know. Yeah. That's a significant thing too.
Are you still in touch with any of the audience?
Actually, yeah, I've seen most of them since then, and there's zero hard feelings, and they're all nice people. But I think looking back, I can see I was a little bit naive about the structure of the band, and I sort of believed in it as a real thing at the time, whereas really, I think Billy, who'd written the songs, he'd called in people, musicians, who were like session musicians to form what the band was, but there wasn't really a massive foundation there for us to stay together. So I understand now why that happened. I think it was only at the time I felt a bit wounded by that.
What were your A-levels in? I'm just asking you because no one ever asks.
No, they really don't. English, history and history of art. What about you?
Oh, my God, stop.
No.
English, history, French and AS history of art.
Okie dokie. Maybe, yeah.
That's so funny.
Okay. That is really funny.
But actually, that's a seamless link into your second failure, which is being crap at drawing.
Yeah.
It's quite left field, this one. Why did you choose it?
Well, firstly, I am properly crap at drawing. It's really annoying. I think I plateaued in my start of drawing at about, I'm going to go 12, 13. Mm-hmm. So if I draw a person, they will be front on, their hands will be like that, their feet will be like out that way. I can't really draw. And the reason I chose it, I think your podcast is so clever with this, because failure is such a defining thing anyway, but also this one failure made me realize that everything I think I've ever done is because the road there has been boxed by all the things I can't do. So if I'd been really good at like literally anything else, I'd probably be doing that. Mm. But so when I pulled the thread of not being able to draw, like it was like a jumper, like my whole life kind of went to the thread on the floor, because I think I'm one of these people where if something doesn't come naturally to me, I'm very unlikely to pursue it.
Yeah.
And I used to think everybody felt like that, but then I realized, no, people work really hard and they do things like practicing their instruments or whatever else it might be. It's just me. When I was a kid, I always thought there was an instrument that I could pick it up and I was just going to be able to play it, like virtuoso.
Yeah.
I really believed it. Like one day I will find that instrument, and I realized, no, that's not literally not how it works.
Yeah.
But I think that shows you why I never, that's how I draw. So. And so it stayed. It plateaued.
That's like me in sport, team sport. I'd just be like, no, I can't do this. It's humiliating. So I'm going to stop immediately. That's very interesting psychology. So did singing come naturally to you from the off?
Yeah, I didn't do music at school or anything like that. I used to like singing, but I've never studied it. I didn't do music GCSE or A-level or anything like that. It was just a thing I felt like, oh, yeah, this is comfy. And obviously over the time you practice and hone, it does come. But I think if it had taken significant effort, I probably would have got a bit bored and done something else.
What do you like with your own children? Do you encourage them to put effort into...
The hot topic in our house.
Okay.
So I treat them the way that I want to be treated, and I think pretty much the way I was brought up, actually, which is that if they're not that interested or bothered, I'll say, OK, let's leave that, and I pursue the things they are naturally curious about, which sounds like really wholesome on the surface, but really what that means is... Like, for example, I've got two of them that do instruments, but they don't practice. And I'm like, well, they just don't practice. Whereas Richard's like, no, we're supposed to put that into the structure of their day. But I think, well, if they were going to do it, they'd just do it, won't they?
Okay. And that's why it's a hot topic in your house.
It is. It's probably like one of the biggest things that we feel differently about. Because actually most of the stuff we feel quite similarly, but that's one that prompts the most sort of conversation, I think. Yeah.
I'm aware that your mum is in the audience, so maybe it's odd for me to be asking you this when I could be asking her, but I want to know what you were like as a child. When you were 4 or 5, how would you describe yourself?
Oh, my goodness. Does anyone know how to describe themselves at 4 or 5?
Well, I think I know, but I think maybe that's because they were words that were given to me about who I was rather than how I felt myself. Mm. I mean, stubborn was the one that was often used about me. Liked to read.
I mean, definitely always creative. And I think I was quite social. But I was also an only child till I was 8. And I think that does play a part, because it means you spend a lot of time in adult company, sometimes being bored, but other times having to sort of find a way to make conversation or slip in with what's going on. But I think the specific ages you picked as well, that's literally when my mum and dad were separating and divorcing. So that probably would have made an impact on what kind of 4 or 5 year old I was. I don't know. I feel like I do need to ask my mum. Mum, what was I like?
Absolutely lovely, says Janet Ellis, black marketeer of Blue Peter badges. Don't give an R to her. It's going to be handcuffed and marched off.
True, we were.
Shoreditch police station.
We were partnered in crime by that stage, so.
Oh, I do remember reading something that your mum said about you. It was in the Sunday Times Relative Values feature, and it was really beautiful. And Janet said, I would never describe myself as Sophie's best friend, but I think we are kindred spirits. Mm. And I can catch her eye across a crowded room and know what's going on in her head. And I think she does that for me.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, and I think I really love the fact that my mum always said that she's not my best friend, because we definitely have a mother-daughter relationship, and I really like that. It's the only person I have that with. That's great.
Yeah.
I've got friends, but I've only got one mum.
Will you explain to us a bit about your family structure? Because you said you were an only child until the age of 8, and then you became part of this magnificent-sounding blended family.
Yeah.
And I wonder what that was like, because they're very hard things to create and make smooth.
Well, I guess I don't think you do create and make smooth the things that are, I think a lot of it relies on just the chemistry of it working, actually. I think my mum chose with my stepdad an amazing man, so that made the process a lot easier, because neither of us, we weren't really kind of trying to figure it out, it just unfolded, if you know what I mean. It wasn't like a big moment of like sitting down and, you know, okay, so now you're this role and I'm that. I mean, at the beginning, it was definitely a little bit clunky, because John had never really spent any time with children. And so we met when I was 7, and he had this very sort of dry northern wit. And the first Christmas we spent together, his Christmas present to me was a packet of balloons that said "Happy Birthday, Jane," which he thought was really funny.
That is hilarious.
Yeah, but I was so confused. Oh, I just didn't understand what was going on with that. but we found our way completely, and I think all the best relationships, they don't really ever need explaining or working out, do they? But I do, yeah, so my mum and John married, and then actually a little bit similar to me, they found out they were having my brother Jack when they'd been together for 3 months. So, you know, took their time. And then I was absolutely obsessed with Jack, my little brother, obsessed with him. And then my dad married my stepmom, Polly, I think maybe like the year after Mum and John got married. So she's been there since I was little as well. And I have a brother and two sisters on that side and another sister on my Mum and John side now. So there's lots of us now, yeah.
Yeah. So I'm a stepmother. In fact, I've been a stepmother twice. If you could give any advice from the perspective of the child to a step-parent or someone whose partner has a child, what would that advice be?
Oh, there's loads of good stuff. But I think the most important one, actually, is never slag off the other parent. Just don't get involved in the drama between the mum and the dad. Just don't get involved. Don't make a comment about it. Mm. Obviously, you can be supportive to your partner behind closed doors, but as a child, you don't want to hear anybody trying to reason, you know, why your dad needs to see you more or whatever. And I hope my stepmom wouldn't mind saying that that's what she did when I was little, and I just really struggled with that. I think that's actually probably the main thing, like, and just take your time. I mean, it's quite a big deal if you're in single digits and find that there's a new significant other. And the thing my parents both did that was brilliant is they didn't introduce their other halves until they knew it was a serious thing. So it wasn't like there was a bit when my mum was dating like loads of people and I didn't meet hardly any of them.
Well, we're really discovering an awful lot about Janet Ellis.
Yeah, it was wild. Yeah. I'd be like, who are you seeing tonight? She's like, oh, I'm off to see so-and-so. I only met, I think, two boyfriends before my stepdad. One of them was really cool because he actually kept monkeys.
Oh, that is cool.
Yeah, two monkeys.
Yeah.
I know.
In the house?
Yeah, in the house. So we go around there and I'd be left with the monkeys for a bit. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the best piece of advice. If you're a step-parent.
Yeah, get some monkeys.
Just get the monkeys in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think if you're a step-mum, you're kind of trying to be like a slightly fun, you're not trying to be a parent person.
100%.
I think it's something other, but that other can be really significant.
Yeah.
And I can see the trace of all my parents in me. I can see, you know, all of them. I know I've been raised by my step-parents too. I can feel that. I know
that's
it's there.
That's a beautiful thing to say. Very generous thing to say. And I think that's great advice. I really enjoy the role of actively not being a parent in that scenario because I do think that there is a function that you can serve that is not about disciplining or saying, no, eat your broccoli, or it's actually someone who is hopefully relaxing to be around and allows you to be yourself. And I think you're also right that it takes time and that people, if anyone is relating to this in the audience, you shouldn't beat yourself up if it doesn't happen immediately. I think a lot of films are really unhelpful in that regard because
it's a big deal. And once the foundation's there, it just flows. You don't have to worry about it anymore. And like, you know, that was one thing about when John died that was actually incredible, was that I knew there was nothing we needed to say to each other. And that's huge if you're losing someone. It's huge if you're just very at peace with your relationship with that person. That meant so much to me. And I was really aware of that. That was lovely.
Yeah. How would you describe yourself as a parent, other than someone who doesn't make them practice musical instruments? What do you think are your greatest strengths as a parent and your greatest weaknesses?
I do know that I talk about things a lot, and I hope that's good. I'm trying to raise people that aren't afraid to communicate anything or have those conversations. There's probably a lot of energy with my parenting sometimes, but I think my kids have learned to sort of chill out with me a little bit. Mm-hmm. I hope it's a lot of fun. I do try and have a lot of fun. I think childhood's so precious, and it just doesn't last that long, and there's lots of ways that, you know, they see the window into what happens next, and we just try and walk in step with them really and see the world through their eyes as much as possible really. I've got five very different kids, and so it matters to me that they feel really seen for who they are. I never try and clump them together. They're all definitely five individuals, and they all want different things and go about things different ways. So I think that's probably my best thing, is probably the communication thing. Mm. I think the worst thing is probably just spreading myself a bit thin with things, really, be it with them or with work. That's always tough. But then I think that's probably why I started my podcast, because yeah. I got a bit obsessed with this thing of how you calibrate being a working woman who's also raising a family. I think that's probably been the something that bothers working women for time eternal, really.
Are there specific challenges to raising five boys in this particular environment? The reason I ask that is because I have friends who have both boys and girls, and my best friend was telling me the story about how her son went to the playground one day and there were girls in his class walking around with t-shirts that said girls rule the world and girls are the best, and basically saying to each other boys are rubbish. And he felt, he's a very sensitive child, and he felt really sad by that. He was like, why am I no good? And I wondered, like, sometimes that's the flip side that you don't often hear, and I wondered if you've had any experience of that and if there are a particular set of challenges.
Well, I completely understand where your friend's coming from with that, but actually I still think on the whole, just the way that everything is so gendered is really exhausting. And I think the moment I had my first baby and he happened to be a boy, I was so disappointed and surprised by how much expectation there was about who he was going to be just because he happened to be male. I was really like, how can anything be that binary? Like, yeah. Obviously, whenever anything's being recalibrated, things can go a little bit too far the other way. So, you know, you shouldn't have any t-shirt that said either gender is better than the other. But I do think on the whole, like, the other day I went into a shop and it had two walls of clothing, and there was definitely the boys' side and the girls' side. The girls, like, why did they decide? Like, girls get horses, we get that, we get puppies, we get butterflies, rainbows. Boys, they get construction things, cars, lions, dinosaurs. Mm. I'm just like, I don't get it. Like, why is it so gendered? And then I think one of the boy things says something like, you're a champ, or here comes trouble, or something. And I just think all of that is so naff. It looks really archaic to me. So I think for me, when the moment I had my first baby, I just wanted them to feel like they had choice and options. And then they can really listen and support everybody. Like, my sons have friends from all different backgrounds, all different genders. Like, that's exactly how it should be. They should just be looking at people. Yeah. That's what I'm raising. I'm raising people.
Oh, I love that so much. It's such a welcoming ethos that is also reflected in your music. I feel that everyone is welcome in 100%. What you put out into the world.
Yeah.
Your third and final failure, which is such an interesting one, is your failure to give yourself a room of your own.
Yes.
Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, I suppose it's literal and metaphorical, but I think initially it was very literal, and I realised it a lot during lockdown, where I realised the whole house, there was nowhere in the house that was just mine. Every room was someone else's or a communal space. My husband's got a studio he could go into, but I didn't have anywhere. It was just for me to go to. And obviously, that's quite decadent anyway. Like, I can't expect that, but it would be really lovely to have a space just to go to where it's just my things and my thoughts. But actually, I think it was also metaphorical, because I realized, and actually this has been maybe quite late, you know, I've been quite late to realize this, but I hadn't really given enough space, enough room to actually my work. I think in the home, I'd always talked it down and put it to one side. And if I was going out for the day, I'd be like, oh, I'm just doing this little thing and I'll be back later, but it's nothing, or I don't really want to be doing it. I want to be here with you, to the kids, or whatever. And then I thought, actually, hell no, I really love what I do. And I've worked really hard to get some of the opportunities I have. And I've just given it more space, more room. And that's been really good for me. I really needed to do that, especially in your 40s. Have you watched the J-Lo halftime thing on Netflix?
Yes, I have.
Oh my God.
Love it.
Now, there's someone who built herself a bloody room. That's a mansion. But she's like, she's so empowering with
it. Yes, she is.
She's like, I can do this. I can be bigger like that. Like, I loved it.
Yeah.
I got a bit obsessed.
I love it too. No, I'm totally obsessed with J-Lo as well.
Yeah.
And I love all music documentaries on Netflix.
Yeah.
The Taylor Swift one is also excellent.
Oh, I haven't watched that yet.
Oh, and the Billie Eilish one on Apple is also... Anyway, that's a tangent. Why do you think that for so long you hadn't given yourself that? Do you think it was that sort of apologetic, well, I'll fit my work around all stuff? Yeah.
I think lots of things are a bit of a choice or a gear you can slip into. And there are lots of ways that all of us do that all the time. And just some of them I just started... I think actually, weirdly, it's probably through doing the podcast and having lots of conversations with people. And you start to slightly, you know, tap on things, don't you, and like open lids to boxes that you hadn't really done for a while. And they're like, I realized I kept saying in interviews with people, yes, I really would love a room of my own. And I was like, I don't, what am I really talking about there? And I realized it was actually just giving it space and a bit of gravitas and significance. And I think, I don't know, maybe because sometimes my work is a bit of a, I'm not uncomfortable, that's too strong a word, but it does take me away from the kids and it does demand a lot of me sometimes. And maybe I was just always trying to play it down a little bit.
Yeah, you should be unafraid of taking yourself seriously.
Yeah, exactly. That's another thing, actually. I realized I used to say, like, oh, I'm stupid or I'm an idiot or things like this, just in conversation about myself all the time. I still do it a bit, but I've tried to be a bit better about that, actually. It's not a great way to talk about yourself, is it?
It isn't, and you would never talk to your best friend like that.
No, God.
So you shouldn't be talking to yourself like that. I had this a sort of similar conversation with Catelyn Moran last night about the power of a compliment and how, as women and people of any gender who struggle with self-worth, if someone says, oh, you look great, you should say thank you and that's it. And if someone says, oh, I like your boots, you shouldn't be like, oh God, these are just from Zara. They're like, oh, don't even look at them. Don't look at me, I'm terrible. Like, it's that kind
I
had a period in my life where I realized, I wrote a novel called Paradise City, and one of the characters was this bombastic billionaire called Howard Pink, who walked around the world as if he owned it. And I realized that I had it within me to write that character. And not only that, but it was really fun. Like, he was super rich and super entitled. I was like, so I have that. I managed to do that, to inhabit that. So I must have that skill somewhere within me. And I looked at the emails I was sending at work. At the time, I was a feature writer on The Observer. And the emails I would send to my editor were like, this is probably a rubbish idea. Don't even listen to me. I'm so sorry. Yeah. Might you have a moment? Might you just consider this thing? It's just a thing that I just, you know, don't even worry. Actually, forget I said anything.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I'm the same. That's exactly.
Yeah. And no one's going to say, yes, that sounds like a great idea. Let's put it in the paper.
Yeah.
Because you have made yourself sound like you don't believe in it.
Absolutely. And it's really easy to dismiss something if someone set it up like that, isn't
it?
You go, okay, well, yeah, we don't really need it. Thanks.
And I realized if I could be a bit more like that bombastic billionaire.
Yeah.
If I could just take 5% of his arrogant entitlement and write my emails as if I were 5% him.
Yeah.
And so that's what I started doing. I just stripped out all the mitigating words, and it really worked.
I was going to say, I bet people didn't think anything more than just, there was just more clarity in what you said.
100%.
More confidence, that's good. Okay, I'm going to take some of that as well.
Yeah, my life advice is to be 5% of an arrogant, entitled billionaire.
Done.
Okay? That's my mantra for life.
I like it.
So how is your room of your own now?
Well, I don't literally have a room of my own, that's fine.
Why not?
Why not? Where would I put it? I haven't got a space for a room.
You're Sophie Ellis Bextor. Could you not build one of those sort of garden shed things that's half office?
I thought about that, actually, and funnily enough, Catelyn Moran has one of those.
It's my dream.
Yeah,
like, that's actually my life
goal. They're really beautiful. Yeah, maybe one day. There's not room for it right now, but I think the metaphorical room has been built now. I'm much, much better. Like, with this summer, I did a ridiculous amount of gigs, which was amazing. Like, no complaint. It was incredible. But it meant that the summer was really busy. And I said to the kids, like, do you understand that every time I get booked for a show, like, there's so many people they could book, but they decided to book me, and I've been doing what I do for a really long time, so it would be fine if they don't book me. But they did. So I'm going to really go for it. And I think it actually made them more appreciative, and, like, they just kind of understood a bit more about why I was going out and doing what I do, like, and why it mattered to me. And that's, everybody's better for that, aren't they? Nobody's walking away worse off.
You did tell me before we came on stage that I could ask you anything.
You can.
Okay. This is a really big question, but I'm intrigued to hear what you'll say. Do you have self-worth?
Oh, I hope so. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, but I guess you get your self-worth by partly by making sure that you surround yourself with nice people, and then you feel good to be around them. And if I ever feel any wobbliness, I just look at the people that are my friends, and I think, well, I can't be all bad if that's who's around me.
That is so lovely.
It's true, though. I think probably most people feel like that, don't they? You know who you are when you have your friends reflect you back at yourself, don't you?
Yes, especially if you're being fully yourself with them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they still like you.
Yeah.
Flaws and all.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's the best friendships.
What do you think your failures have taught you?
Well, the biggest one is probably just about not fearing things going wrong, actually. I think that that's particularly for anyone creative, because you're kind of permanently, you have to be your own cheerleader. Like, if I stopped what I do tomorrow, no one's going to come banging on my door saying, no, you must do. I have to be the one to put myself out there again and again. So I think that thing of just thinking, if the rug gets pulled under me... In fact, actually, I think I run towards it a little bit now.
Do you?
Yeah, I've definitely done things and taken on challenges that purely because I think I'm getting a bit too comfortable here. Let's push. I like that feeling. I like being a little bit pushed out of comfort zone. This also taught me I'm lazy. My failures have taught me I'm brave.
Yeah. No, I think failures teach you that you can take a risk, and actually the greatest failure is maybe not taking the risk in the first place because you deny yourself adventures.
I also think you can choose a lot about how you your perspective on things, can't you? And I think maybe through my mum's eyes, actually, I've inherited, and we have a tendency to be quite pragmatic. I'm not someone for regret. Mm. So however the cards fall, I'll try and find the best outcome from that, really. Yeah. There's always something, a little silver lining in there, isn't there?
Now, before we go to the audience for a Q&A, so do be thinking of any questions you'd like to ask. A new season of Strictly Come Dancing has just started.
Yes.
You are a former contestant.
Yeah.
What advice would you have for the contestants this season after your experience?
Oh, just, I mean, I think actually, well, there's the sort of light thing of just really have fun, because it's so fleeting. You don't do it for very long, and it is, a lot of it's really magical. But actually, on a more practical note, I would say incorporate dancer face when you're rehearsing. Okay. And what I mean by that is when I was first, I remember I was in the car on my way to my first ever rehearsal with Brendan Cole, who I was paired with, and I thought, oh, I've just suddenly remembered, I don't really like dancing when you, like, touch the other person.
Awkward.
Really awkward, especially with doing, like, a waltz. So for about the first three dances, I couldn't really look him in the eye. I found it really intimidating. And I would be learning it in a kind of very practical way, like, okay, my feet are doing this, my hands are doing that, that's my body. And then the face would be like the last thing I'd think of. Mm. So on the night when you've been quite tense, basically your muscle memory learns everything. So if you haven't done the face before, it's quite hard to suddenly like pop that little dancer head on top. Yeah. So I'd say do dancer face from day one, like bring it. I couldn't do it, but now I'd be like, yeah, whatever, doesn't matter. I think I was a bit self-conscious about looking like I was trying too hard.
Yeah, you were saying earlier
even though I was trying really hard.
It taught you about performance.
Oh, definitely.
What did it teach you?
I think it just took away a few layers of inhibition because it was so extreme. I've never done any choreography before, so it was so far away from anything I'd done before. I mean, I love dancing on a dance floor. Like, that's really fun, but this was, you know, you're actually trying to do something proper. And I think that seeing the dancers, they take everything to the extreme. Everything is huge. And I thought, oh, you know what, on stage, what feels like you're going a bit too big, you're never going too big. So I think now I use my whole body a lot more on stage. I dance a lot more on stage. I don't think you'd recognise it as like proper Strictly Come Dancing dancing, but I'm having a lovely time.
I love that as a note to end on, that you can never go too big.
No, you can't. And also, dancing just feels amazing, doesn't it? It's such a tonic. It's like the best feeling ever.
You can never go too big, and your failures end up leading you here.
Yes.
How has this been for you, by the way?
Gorgeous. You're so lovely to talk to. It's been really nice.
Thank you. I wasn't fishing for a compliment, but thanks very much. And if there are any more compliments anyone would like to give me, I'm very needy. So, no, I'm kidding. It's been a total delight for me. Thank you for being such a wonderful interviewee and such an inspiring guest. Please give it up for Sophie Ellis-Bextor.
Thank you. Cheers.
So now we're coming to you, lovely people. Yeah. The house lights are going to go on. And if anyone would like to ask a question, just put your hand up. And then if you could wait for a microphone to come to you, that would be really wonderful. Yes, we're going to come to you on the side. Yes, you're waving your arms. Thank you. The microphone is coming to you.
Such an amazing talk. Thank you, Sophie. I've just got to ask the question. Where did the inspiration for Murder on the Dance Floor come from? You haven't sung a rendition yet. I'll leave that there.
Great question.
So, Murder on the Dance Floor was mostly written by a guy called Greg Alexander, who's a very talented singer-songwriter. And he had written it when he wanted to go clubbing and he couldn't, his car wouldn't start. And he was just in his car with his guitar writing this kind of cross song about wanting to go clubbing. So it was about murder on the dance floor. And then I heard it when it was just on a little cassette and it just had the chorus. And then he'd kind of just thrown in some random lyrics with the other bits. So I kind of finished it off. So some of the lyrics I put in was this bit where it said, "You better not steal the moves." And then Greg phoned me. We'd never met and he phoned me and he went, "Sophie, you better not steal the moves, Sophie." And I couldn't work out if he was like, really cross with me or he liked it.
Did he say hello kind of first or he went straight?
No,
literally just went straight into the...
he's quite an enigmatic kind of guy.
Okay.
But yeah, we ended up working together and everything, so it was all good in the end. But yeah, the nice thing is I'm still on really good terms with songs like that and Groove. I'm still really happy to sing them, which I think is such a nice thing, because I know a lot of singers don't feel like that about their songs that people know them for, but I'm always happy to sing it.
I recently interviewed Mel C of the Spice Girls, and she said that she sometimes does karaoke with Baby Spice, Emma Bunton, and they will surprise other karaoke goers who are doing Spice Girl songs by just walking in.
Amazing.
Being like, "Hi, have you ever done that? And will you ever do that?"
I would. I don't think anyone ever chooses my songs for karaoke.
They're quite hard, to be fair.
They're actually not, but I just think, like, Spice Girls, yes. Like, this is a good choice, but I totally would, so... Yeah, if any of you guys go karaoke later, let me know and I'll come and join.
I love karaoke so much.
It is really good fun, although I think they should sometimes do edit. Some of the songs are really long, aren't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
I like the little videos they do while the lyrics are playing as well.
Yes, the little cartoon karaoke.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Anyone else? Yes, we're right down here at the front again.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm here with my sister and one of my best friends. And my sister coincidentally works, she's a designer at Designers Guild. So
what? Is her name Bella?
Lovely fabric.
It's Daisy, but earlier we were having drinks and we were just talking about like rejection. We're all in our 20s and obviously you've been talking about sort of rejection and failure from sort of a bit further down the line and how you've learnt from that because you know that that led to something better or there was a reason why that happened. But I was just wondering if you have any advice for when you're in that moment of rejection or failure or whatever you think it is, of how you deal with that sort of in the moment rather than being like 10, 20 years down the line and going, "Oh, well, it was for this reason," because you don't have that reason at that time, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it depends a little bit on the circumstance, but I think actually it probably goes a little bit back to the self-worth thing. And so long as you're being spoken to properly and being respected, even if people are telling you that now's not the right time for you to do such and such, I think it's quite good just to try and keep the dialogue open about how you can learn from it. I know it's like a really vague thing to say, but I think that's not being too off that, you know, flying off the handle too much, because it does hurt anyway when you're having that, but just in the moment, just sort of walking away, and then you can come back later and talk things through a bit more, maybe. I mean, it's hard to sort of know when we're not talking about something specific, but...
I think the first thing to say is that if you're hurt, that's completely fine, and that's part of your process, and actually all that shows you is that you're a feeling individual with healthy emotions. So that's number one. And then the thing that I find really helps is to say rejection is protection. If you're rejected by a person, by an employer, by a situation, my belief is that that person, that employer, that situation was not for you and was not serving you in the way that you deserve to be served.
Yeah.
So for instance, if you're rejected by a romantic partner, for me, character is action. If they've acted in that way, they are not for you.
That's very true.
And that's a helpful way, I feel, of taking this thing out of it. The final thing that I would say is, generally, when you're being rejected on a personal level, that's almost everything to do with their stuff and what you trigger in them rather than anything to do with you. I mean, unless you're like an awful, toxic, narcissist, serial murderer and like that, that extreme accepted. People are projecting their own emotions and their own emotional baggage and their own damaged personal history. And so that's a good way of understanding that actually, ultimately, it's not your responsibility to try and change that for them. It's their responsibility to do the work. Your responsibility is to do the work that you want to do on yourself. And so actually, every single time I've been rejected, I've ended up being so grateful for it for that reason.
Yeah, and I think, as you said, when you're hurt, just be kind to yourself. Sometimes you need time where you're just gentle with yourself and just go away and just, you know, heal your wounds a little bit, actually.
Eat cheese. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, that's the other thing that I say, is that when it comes to sort of being rejected by someone's personal opinion of you, that it can be very hurtful, especially if you're a people pleaser. But there are some people in this world who don't like cheese. Now, I find that baffling as someone who just completely loves cheese.
I know one of these people. I'm you're trying to get him to eat cheese.
I just can't understand that, but I respect it. Mm. But it's like, it's not the cheese's fault that you don't like cheese. So that's another way. Just think of yourself as Cathedral City, okay?
Yeah. That's true. But you're right. It always says more about the other person than
yes.
I say that to my kids as well.
Oh.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Anyone else who would like to? Yes. Your microphone is just coming. Thank you for being patient. There we go. There we go. Thank you.
Hi. I'm so sorry that this is quite basic, but we'd love to know where all the boots are from.
Great question.
That's not basic. And what's really tragic is that I'm actually thinking, I might go and get some of them as well.
I'm thinking that
these are fabs. These are Terry de Haviland.
Oh, I love
them. And what's good about them is I came all the way here, like walking, tube, walking, fine. These are pretty foxy though, aren't they?
Okay, so these are Zara. And not
I
only...
love that gasp, like...
I know.
Well done, Zara.
And they also come in electric green, which I was tempted, yeah. I was tempted by.
You know what's really tragic? Elizabeth told me that before we came out, and I was like, oh, wow, I knew that, because I've got the app, and I look at it all the time, so I already know, like, everything that's
you
in Zara.
Knew it.
I did. Because I love Zara, and I was like, those are nice boots. And I was looking at my friend the other day.
Yeah. It's a hard website to navigate, though.
Great.
You need to know where you're going.
It's because they do the thing of swiping different way you expect.
It's very complicated. Ah. I was tempted by the electric green, but I felt silver would go with more things. So that's where the boots
are. They're really
fun.
They're great.
Oh, we love
should go dancing afterwards.
Yes, we're going to go to Fire in Vauxhall.
Yeah. Till the morning. Woo!
Thank you so much. Not basic at all. Okay, yes.
Yeah. Hi, Sophie. Thank you, Elizabeth and Sophie. My question is just, how do you deal with criticism now, especially from people that don't really know you? So I'm thinking like negative reviews and things like that.
That's a great question.
It is a good question. Yeah. I mean, I think broadly speaking, when I first started, I used to get some really nasty stuff said about me online. It could be in a review or it could just be like a comment in something. And it used to really hurt. And then there's the bit where my career kind of goes in the bits where it goes a bit quieter and then no one talks to you. And it's a bit like that, you know, Oscar Wilde thing, isn't it? Like, you know, the only thing worse than being spoken about is not being spoken about. And actually, I've come to this sort of nice feeling now where, like, if someone's so bothered about me that they feel they have to put out into the world that they really find me annoying, I find it kind of satisfying. Like, I've annoyed them that much just by existing. Like, that's quite a power they've given me, right?
Yeah.
But when it comes to criticizing my work, I'm not going to lie, that definitely hurts because I put a lot of myself into it, and it's not just me. I work with people I think are brilliant, and everybody really pulls their weight, and I think, you know, there's I'm supported in every direction, so that can be quite tricky. But but generally, it's just one opinion, and I think you know in yourself if you've done something that's good or not. And sometimes as well, it takes a little while for I always think the goodwill out. It takes a little while for things to find their spot in life, actually. It's not always the first opinion that matters. It can be when things have had a little chance to percolate. And that's the great thing about music, actually. It can sometimes have a moment a little bit later and you go, oh, that's nice. That really makes sense now.
That's a great point. And actually, again, I think it's really important to hear that it hurts. Because it means that you care. It means that you care about what you've created. Yeah. I saw this great thing on TikTok, because I'm really down with the kids. And I think the key to dealing with criticism is really knowing yourself, which is ultimately a very hard thing to do. But there was this guy on TikTok who said, if someone pointed at you and said, I hate your blue hair, it's awful, it looks terrible, it doesn't suit you at all, I don't know why you've dyed it blue, you would go, unless you do have blue hair, you would go, well, I don't have blue hair, so that doesn't affect me. And his point was that people's criticisms of you when they don't know you are equivalent to that. They don't know anything about you, so they're just projecting, they've got a glimmer of something, and they think that they're speaking to that, but they don't actually know that you don't have blue hair, but you need to be the one that knows that about yourself. Yeah. And I find that, like, it's a very hard thing to do, but even just knowing that is the thing to do.
But the hard thing about it is you haven't got a right to reply, and that can be really tricky. If you get a criticism and you think, oh, but you got that a bit wrong, actually.
Yes.
You can't reply to them.
I know.
Unless you always, do, and then that looks terrible.
It's always better not to explain.
And also the thing about, you know, social media is that everybody's got your ear for that tiny minute. So if you look on Twitter and you get something nasty, for that moment, whoever that person is, they've got you.
Yes.
They've been able to speak to you. Well, you know, we never used to have that sort of exchange with people with so many voices.
Yeah.
And something that's like maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 people can feel like a room full of people when you're looking on something like that. But you have to kind of keep it in perspective, really. I think that's slightly down to personality type a little bit as well. I'm able to walk away from it a bit, whereas Richard can sometimes really spiral with something and then I've got to kind of talk it through with him.
Yeah.
If he was here, he'd be like, no, I don't. But
he'd be like, yes, you do, and then he'd take that to heart. He'd go into a spiral.
Exactly.
Richard. Yes, back row over there. And then we are doing a book signing. Sophie is very kindly staying to do one as well.
Yeah, definitely.
So we can't wait to speak to more of you then. Yes.
Hi, Sophie, and hi, Elizabeth.
Hello.
Thank you. It's been a great evening and really great conversation. I am actually one of 5 daughters, and I very rarely meet any mothers who have 5 children. So ultimately, I guess I just want to know if the middle child is your favourite.
I was just going to ask you where you are on the lineup, but no, I don't need to ask that.
I love that question.
I describe my middle child as the heart of the family. I think it's quite a tricky position, but I always say you're right in the middle, you're the heart of the family, which hopefully will...
So yes, basically.
...preserve a minute. But I know, for little Ray Ray.
5 daughters, that's like Jane Austen. You don't have, oh, yeah, can we give her the mic? I really
what are your memories of childhood? Was it fun or was it a bit crazy?
Absolute chaos. Is this Q&A on the Will It Be's?
I can cut your bit out. I mean, the Q&A was going to be, but we can cut it out.
Well, no, I'd actually like to give a shout out to my sister, Debbie Stevens, because she listens to your podcast all the time. But she was getting her hair done months ago, and you were sat behind her, and she was super...
Me or Sophie? Excited.
Must be you.
Elizabeth.
Oh, okay.
I think I haven't been to a hairdresser in months.
Oh, gosh. I was sat behind her in the hairdresser.
Yeah.
Was I okay? Like... What was her experience of me that day?
No, she, she was just very excited. She actually ended up, the guy who was cutting her hair fancied another guy that walked past.
Okay.
And she kind of, like, set them up.
Ooh.
I think she, like, ran out and got the guy. I don't know, but
I remember her.
I remember
her. Yes, that was quite recently. She's so cool. I love that she did that. There was a whole psychodrama. And I love that hairdresser, the Lion and the Fox in Chancery Lane.
Shout out.
Shout out. Shout out to Debbie Stevens. She's my favourite of the 5. Thank you so much. What an amazing note to end on. Thank you for being such a lovely, warm, engaged, fabulous audience. But the biggest thank you of the night, of course, is to the effervescently brilliant Sophie Ellis-Bextor.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode of How to Fail with Elizabeth Day, I would so appreciate it if you could rate, review, and subscribe. Apparently, it helps other people know that we exist.